Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about Clinton getting rich from military contractors, her campaign, that is, Iraq occupation-style surveillance over the streets of Baltimore, and price gouging by pharmaceuticals. But before we can move on, at a fundraiser at the home of hardcore militarist Robert Kagan, supporters of Hillary Clinton vouch for her pro-war bona fides. One speaker at the fundraiser, Amanda Sloat, a former State Department official, in fact, said that Clinton will be more, quote, interventionist than Obama in Syria. Another speaker noted that they would sleep better because Clinton would be tougher on Russia and supply the Ukrainian government with all sorts of weapons. Robert Kagan himself noted that a significant section of Americans actually disagree with these policies and would need much persuasion from President Clinton to not revolt if they were pursued. And just in case you don't know him, let's get a little taste of what Mr. Kagan considers foreign policy successes in the past.
It's no accident that the countries where we have been most successful in fostering this movement toward democracy have either been under our occupation or dependent on the United States.
Given the rush of promoters of more war and regime change to Clinton's side, it might not surprise you to learn Clinton is also collecting more money than Trump from military contractors. She actually holds a 2-to-1 edge in donations. Politico took a look at the donors and found some bold-faced names, including, get ready, former Lockheed Martin CEO Robert Stevens, Edward Congas, who's the board chair at United Technologies, Pam Wickham, the vice president for corporate affairs and communications at Raytheon, John Casey, who leads the Marine Systems Division at General Dynamics, Vivek Lal, a senior executive at General Atomics, and Frank Ruggiero, the top in-house lobbyist at BAE Systems. But that's not it. Also, it included Greta Lundenberg, Boeing's vice president for strategy and advocacy, and a former National Security Council staffer, and Robert Hale, an advisor at Booz Allen Hamilton, also a lobbyist, who was the Pentagon's comptroller under President Obama. Now, that subset of names I just mentioned alone represent companies that in fiscal year 2013 alone received over $107 billion in military contracts. And if there was any wondering about why Clinton is so popular with this crowd, well, in the words of Linda Hudson, formerly of BAE as well, she says, quote, "My view is Hillary is far more aligned with the types of issues that are important to the defense industry than Trump is." So, in other words, Hillary Clinton is more likely to A, go to war, which obviously is good for military contractors, and B, support totally inane and massive military expenditures for things that do not work and don't have much to do with anything other than lining the pockets of said military contractors. This, quite frankly, should be fairly alarming to anyone paying attention to this election. Obviously, there are a range of issues at stake, but the fact that people most responsible for the fiascos in Iraq and Libya, the people who most want war with Russia and China and a deepening intervention in Syria, and the people poised to profit the most from all of this are gleefully rallying around Hillary Clinton. If the news about Baltimore's police seemed like it, well, couldn't get much worse. Here it is. It is much worse. In fact, it turns out that the Baltimore police have been operating a secret, privately funded aerial spying apparatus modeled off the one used by U.S. occupation forces and drone assassination operators. Or as Robert Kagan might say, like the drones we use to promote democracy around the world. The Baltimore police program consists of a Cessna airplane that circles the city for up to 10 hours a day, equipped with cameras that can cover an area of 30 square miles. It both transmits images in real time and stores them on massive hard drives so that they can be reviewed later. The creator of the technology described it by saying, quote, "Imagine Google Earth with TiVo capability." The program is run by Persistent Surveillance Technologies, which is a civilian company led by Ross McNutt, who created this technology for the U.S. military in Iraq during the occupation to help them control large cities. He took his technology, adapted it to civilian use, but has had trouble finding police departments willing to work with him. Baltimore, however, had no qualms, particularly because it didn't cost him anything. John Arnold, a hedge fund manager who was formerly an Enron trader and who also funds all sorts of right-wing political causes like gutting public sector pensions, is funding the program for the city of Baltimore because he is a major proponent of the technology. Now, the crime-fighting capabilities of this technology are not yet proven, but the immense threats to civil liberties, they have already raised serious questions and concerns. McNutt claims that his program is totally safe and that it definitely cannot be abused. Of course he says that. The reality is this. This new technology allows the Baltimore police to look at real-time video and go back and look at video that literally covers tens of thousands of people at any given time. That is, massive portions of the city are under total surveillance and most residents have no idea. Doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that the police, or the company itself, could fairly easily start to use this to assemble dossiers on significant numbers of people to use however they want. It also means that people could be targeted and followed until they commit some infraction, minor or not, or perhaps just put in the same location as something happening and framed. We also, of course, have to reflect on the fact that the recent DOJ report on the Baltimore police showed that they were not only racist and sexist, but in fact, not terribly concerned with constitutional norms in any way. Only someone who is being willfully ignorant about the risks could possibly support mass surveillance on this scale that is not even officially acknowledged by the police and funded by a right-wing billionaire. This is a worrying step in the growth of mass surveillance technology and must be resisted. The ridiculous price gouging that takes place in the pharmaceutical industry is once again under fire as the drug maker Mylan has hiked the cost of EpiPens, a crucial product for those with serious allergies. EpiPens are injection-based devices that, when people are exposed to allergens, are used to help save them from dying, essentially. There has been a five-fold price increase since 2008, with the cost of a two-injector pack now at almost $600, actually just over $600. It's worth noting that drug maker Mylan didn't single out people who could die from allergic reactions for price gouging, but in fact, they raised prices 20% on 24 other products and 100% on 7 products. This reveals a major issue, which is that pharmaceutical companies gain massive profits off people's suffering and lie about it, claiming that they need the money for research. Drug companies put out the talking point that it costs $1.2 billion to bring a new drug to market. Unfortunately for them, academic researchers tested their claim and found that, in fact, it cost on average $75 million. Pretty big difference. The BBC also examined the claims that most drug company profits went to research and development, also known as R&D, and found that, in fact, many larger sums go to advertising over research. Of the top 10 drug companies, literally only one spent more on R&D than advertising. Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer literally spent about double the amount on advertising as they did on research. As one industry insider anonymously told the BBC, they, quote, wouldn't be able to justify, end quote, Pfizer's 42% profit margin if called on to do so in public. Mylan, of course, claims that the price hike doesn't hurt anybody because most people get the drug through their insurance or through a price waiver they give out to those not financially able to afford the drug. Well, if you believe that, I got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are joined in studio to continue our conversation with Brian Becker, who is the host of Radio Sputnik's Loud and Clear show. I suggest you check that out as well. Brian, thank you so much for being on the show.
Glad to be here.
And so, you know, one of the issues that we raised in the beginning of this show that I just think is, you know, quite interesting is this, the majority of military contractors giving their money to Hillary Clinton. She's got a 2-to-1 advantage over Donald Trump. And I think that in and of itself has some, you know, relative issues. But when you look at why these people are supporting her, it's because they say they believe she is generally going to be better on the issues they care about. So from an overall campaign finance perspective, especially in the context of this Clinton Foundation thing, it seems like people who donate money do expect some sort of quid pro quo, even if it's implicit, not explicit.
Well, it could be a quid pro quo in terms of their own contracts, but they also know that the kind of administration that Hillary Clinton would lead would be like an open door for military contractors because her position is hawkish. Her position is an interventionist position. The people that she aligned herself with in the State Department, the fact that she picked Victoria Nuland, a neoconservative and the wife of Robert Kagan, as her spokesperson in 2009 as one of her first acts. That's an indication that she's part of the program. She's with the military industrial complex. She's been there for a long time. Of course, Bill Clinton did the same in the 1990s. She was then First Lady. She, as U.S. Senator from the state of New York, she was an avid supporter of George W. Bush's war in Iraq. I mean, the military-industrial complex, they know what they're doing, whether they get direct contracts from Hillary Clinton or they know that this administration is going to be bound by the principles of enhancing American military strength, not just in one place, but all around the world. They know that's going to be very good for business.
And I mean, I wonder, it seems to me that this issue of foreign policy is being underplayed in this election. I mean, this seems, you know, pretty remarkable. Bill Perry, who is the Secretary of Defense under President Clinton, the first President Bill Clinton, you know, he wrote a book recently about nuclear arms. And he said that right now is the time where the nuclear war is at the greatest chance of happening in the time he's been working on it. And part of the reason is because of the jingoism going on, the saber rattling going on in regards to Russia. And here we are, Robert Kagan, for instance, who hosted a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton, raised $25,000, making a big part of his pitch that, well, she's going to be more aggressive in Russia, more aggressive in Syria, more aggressive in interventionist, actually used that term, all around the world. I mean, this seems like a much bigger issue than what it's getting on the CNNs and MSNBCs of the world.
Well, I agree with the idea that it's more dangerous, but I don't think the reason is because of the rhetoric or the inflamed character of the rhetoric or the jingoism, however we want to describe it. I mean, at parts of the Cold War, the jingoism was off the charts. I mean, when I was a kid, we were preparing for thermonuclear war all the time. I mean, we were getting under our desks. We were doing the duck and cover. I mean, the whole country was mobilized in a very jingoistic, bombastic way. But here's the real thing, I think, Eugene, and the reason I think it's more dangerous. During the so-called Cold War, there became an equilibrium of power. The Soviets achieved military parity both in nuclear weapons and in other conventional weapon systems. And so there was what we called then mutually assured destruction. If anyone was to inaugurate a global war, a nuclear war, all sides would be exterminated, and that became a deterrent. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, after the collapse of the socialist bloc, after the collapse of the Warsaw Pact countries, you have now a preponderance of power in the United States. The United States spends more militarily than the next 20 countries combined. When you compare a Russian military budget, say this year, compared to the Pentagon's, $609 billion for the Pentagon, less than $85 billion for Russia. So we have a disequilibrium in military power. So I think the danger of war comes from those who feel that they have power, real power, disproportionate power, and there is the arrogance of power, and then there is misstep, overreach. And I think we saw that in the case of Ukraine or the buildup of NATO forces on Russia's border in the Baltics and in Poland. These are the kind of reckless, hubris-based, arrogant-based decisions that actually make the world less safe.
No, absolutely. And I think the consequences of war oftentimes not as well understood as perhaps they should be. And I mean, to me, it just seems like in the way that it's underplayed, there's a lot of intellectual dishonesty in the media because, and I think the way it's presented is, and they even do this in the presidential debates, there's the domestic debate, then there's the foreign policy debate. But I mean, you know, one of the other stories we did off the top here is how the Baltimore police are now using the persistent surveillance developed by the same guy that developed it for the occupation forces, American occupation forces in Iraq, to surveil Baltimore City under the control of Baltimore PD, who's been exposed as so racist and sexist and so on and so forth. I mean, it seems like as much as ever, Martin Luther King's phrase that the bombs that explode in Vietnam also explode in our own communities, yet it's never presented like that in the mainstream discourse.
And there's the other factor, sort of the one that you were alluding to, which is the migration of battlefield equipment, battlefield technologies, including battlefield-based surveillance systems, back to the domestic policing operations of police forces and other armed forces of the state back at home. And by the way, Eugene, this isn't exactly a new phenomena. The United States, when it invaded the Philippines in 1899, 1900, 1901, a million Filipinos died, but they couldn't control the Philippines. The Filipino resistance was great. So the American government created a national surveillance state in the Philippines. And there's been recent scholarship done on this about how those surveillance technologies and systems then migrated back into the United States around 1910 to 1920 where the United States set up a system which became later the FBI and the Red Scares of that time. I mean, all of those battlefield technologies, when a government aggregates power and military technologies somewhere, it will use them everywhere because it becomes a tool in the toolkit.
Well, and I think it's an important reality because I think when people raise, you know, issues with this, people say, oh, well, you know, they have all these safeguards. They have this. They have that. And I mean, it just seems like there's just an unbelievable fiction that people think you can build up a huge surveillance state that can look at everything you do at all times and just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's not going to be, I mean, maybe not from the user's abuse, but from our perspective, that is not going to be abused.
Yeah, and look at the NSA, for instance. I mean, the NSA is a huge behemoth. It's a global power. It surveils and spies on everyone, including all the governments of the world, including American allies. Now, the American Congressional Oversight Committee in the House and in the Senate, they're supposedly the overseers. They're in charge. They're the watchdogs. But they're bound by security premises so that even though they knew the NSA was breaking laws, carrying out mass bulk surveillance against all the people of the world, including all the American people, doing it without probable cause or suspicion that people had committed some crime, those Congress people couldn't speak out because they were bound. In other words, the surveillance state becomes and demands an oath of allegiance, even by the elected officials, the representatives of democracy who are supposed to be guaranteeing the will and the rights of the people overseeing these technologies. The technologies actually oversee the overseers, and that's the reality.
No, I think that's 100% the case. And I just wonder, moving forward as a last point here, I mean, what do you really see is behind, swinging back to the military contractor issue, Hillary Clinton courting people like Madeleine Albright and Henry Kissinger, who have been so widely reviled all around the world as war criminals? She probably doesn't need their support to win. I mean, it was almost certainly doesn't need their support to win because they only have support amongst the bourgeoisie, not the masses of people. Why would you go to get this support?
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton is the symbol of American imperial power. She really is. I mean, the fact that she's a Democrat and the fact that she's a woman shouldn't make us forget. We should have a longer historical memory. You know, when I was a teenager, Eugene, we were chanting, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" That wasn't the Republicans. That wasn't Kissinger. That was the Democrats. The Democrats handed off the war to the Vietnam War to the Republicans. The Republicans did the same thing. They dropped Agent Orange on people. They dropped bombs on the Vietnamese people. When the Democrats were running the war, 1 million Vietnamese died. When the Republicans were running the war, another 1 million people died. So Hillary Clinton is part of the ruling class imperial system, part of the consensus opinion of the foreign policy establishment, which sees the United States not as a democracy, but as a global empire, and they have to watch over the interests of the empire. If you want to be president of the United States, you have to demonstrate, I'm going to be a good CEO of this imperial state. In fact, they don't think Donald Trump is really capable to be that same kind of CEO of the imperial state. That's why she, Hillary Clinton, is the preferred candidate.
Mm-hmm. And that was Brian Becker of the Loud and Clear Show, also on Radio Sputnik. Please check that out. We are going to take a break, but we will be back with more on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the role of culture in recent uprisings in America, the calls for global resistance, and how we can build intersectional movements. And we are joined by an expert panel, as always. In fact, Bomani Armo, writer, poet, music producer, MC, and art integration specialist, China Dickerson, executive director of DC Young Democrats, and our very own Sean Blackman, a news analyst here at Radio Sputnik, as well as just a really, really intelligent person. So don't prove me wrong, Sean. Thank you all for joining the show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yes.
So let's start, I guess, with our current moment, our current political campaign, something that we talk about quite a bit on this show, but I want to sort of shift gears in what we're talking about. You know, one of the big things in this election, right, is that every candidate wants to be quote unquote relatable. Remember, Barack Obama came out with the candidate you want to have a beer with, that kind of reality. So Obviously, these people, though, I mean, Trump is allegedly a billionaire. Hillary Clinton has $100 million, whatever it may be. So they're actually nothing like normal people. And especially when it comes to Black America, you just sort of wonder how they're going to relate. So, Bomani, I'll start with you. I mean, how effective do you think it is for Hillary Clinton getting the Black vote to have hot sauce in her bag and to be pretty legit at Domino's?
I don't know about the Domino's thing. I've heard that she has hot sauce in her bag, and that was something she did before she became famous, Hillary Clinton. And I will give her that.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I'll try to give it that. You don't sell as much hot sauce these companies do if only Black people were buying it.
True.
I hadn't heard the Domino's statement, but relating to either of them is impossible. I don't know what recent presidential nominee has been relatable to the average American. I think they have to show us that they relate to the issues, because I remember. That was Bush's big selling point, that all the people that was running for president, he would be the one you'd want to have a beer with.
Right.
But I think that's mostly because he's like a drunk frat white guy. You know what I'm saying? So I don't even know how much that really counts anymore. I don't relate to either of them personally.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, George Bush's other thing is that he would pray with you, too. Well, China, I don't know what you think. You are the executive director of DC Young Democrats. You work in politics. I mean, do these little things like, yeah, you know, we like hot sauce, I can play dominoes, you know, I'm listening to Lil Wayne like Barack Obama. I mean, do these little things make a difference? Or, I mean, do they turn people off, actually, because it seems so contrived?
I agree with Bomani in that it's more important for them to show that they can relate to another group's issues, but not like that we can hang out. And it's actually, I think, offensive, condescending, patronizing, and all of the other synonyms that describe you giving a description of your personal self that you think I would be inclined to want to like hang out with you in the club, like, because that doesn't matter. I think what matters most, for example, when I talk about Hillary, I don't talk about her being Secretary of State or Senator or the First Lady, because her issue with millennials, those descriptions of her, that part of her experience, that women millennials would not be able to relate to that. So you talk more about like the Children's Defense Fund stuff, how she was a defense attorney. You know, you talk more about those things people actually could aspire to and then achieve. I agree with Bomani that it should be more about the issues. We have children, CHIP. That makes sense. That's children's insurance. People have children needs insurance for their children. So those are the things that they should be talking about. I don't think they are. And so their decision to talk about hot sauce and not children's insurance is actually counterproductive.
Sean, I'll ask what you think here. I guess the other wrinkle, though, is to some degree, it seems like people do kind of like that. It does feel like, I don't know. I mean, you see people going to the fish fries and all of that. And it seems as if, you know, Mike Pence getting that haircut in Indianapolis with the black barber. It seems to some degree that maybe there is a desire for people to have these benchmarks. But go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, a lot of it just feels like pandering to me, man, honestly. Like, whether Clinton, you know what I'm saying, carries hot sauce in her bag or not. I mean, even if you look at the DNC, I mean, they opened with the black choir and they had Boys to Men on stage. And they even bought like
the no one was in the thing, too. Nobody was in there. And boy, they were working so hard on stage. Go ahead.
And that's what I'm saying. And see, and all I could think about is, OK, I mean, this is a woman who supported measures that literally helped put a million black folks behind bars, right? And as Secretary of State, instigated campaigns to bomb brown folks in the Middle East and other places, and if elected president, will escalate that bombing. But, you know, we're all supposed to smile and dance and sing to Motown Philly and forget about all that. So I just don't, it just seems utterly faked.
All the Philly steaks you can eat. Well, you know, I have to say the best political cartoon I've seen so far this election is one, and it's two people. It looks like they're in Afghanistan, and, you know, they're down in Afghanistan, and there's a drone above them, and it's dropping a bomb that they can't fully see yet. And the guy says to the woman, it's a man and a woman, he says, you know, I heard that the next one of these is going to come from a female president. And the woman says, wow, it really just makes you feel like you're a part of history, doesn't it? I don't know. To me, that was my favorite one. But, you know, shifting gears a little bit here, China, I mean, and perhaps a more serious note representationally, I mean, obviously, I agree with Sean. I think that a lot of it is pandering. But down ballot, outside of the presidential race, are we seeing more people of color, transgender folks, women who are actually coming out and running and, you know, at least to some degree, seeming more representational of a lot of formerly marginalized or continually marginalized population?
100%. I think, of course, all politics is local. And so I think we are seeing much more women of color. I mean, just very quickly, you have Lisa Rochester in Delaware. You have Val Demings in Florida. You have Kamala Harris in California. You have Susana Mendoza, Kim Fox in Illinois. You have tons of women running for state's attorney's positions. Marilyn Mosby in Baltimore, not this particular election, but she will be running for re-election in 18. So there are tons of women.
That's a good idea.
Go ahead. So there are tons of women running across the board, not to even mention, you know, going all the way down to school board. But even outside of race and ethnicity, you also have women who would come from, I would say, a lower socioeconomic status, who have been getting support. I think because we have folks like Bernie and, dare I say it, Trump, who have been able to gain traction just from keeping it real, we're finding that even with
Trump is keeping it real.
We find that even with campaign finance reform, that folks are winning and not raising as much money as their opponents. There's a ton of that now. Our women are not raising as much money as these incumbent men, and they're winning.
Well, and Bomani, let me ask you this. I mean, I think in general, I think that's a good thing. I mean, I'm the type of guy that sort of, all things being equal, let's just get as much diversity in there. It's not the only thing, but like, let's just do that and cover that point. But I mean, it just seems like that. I feel two ways about it, though, because then you look at Obama, you look at other people, and it almost feels like a smug. The more I can relate to you, almost like as a individually, not politically now, the more it almost feels like a trick to me. Like, wow, why do I like you so much outside of your ideology? Like, it almost feels like a setup.
You had Bill Clinton on saxophone popping into my head the minute you said that.
Yes.
And so I think it's a matter of how you come to that relatability. I think if that relatability, if you feel like the relatability is being sold to you, I think we're all mature enough and media savvy enough, and most Americans are, to notice that they're being sold to. You know what I'm saying? But then there's sometimes you just realize that y'all come from the same place. And if they keep talking and if they keep explaining where they're from, then you realize that you come from the same place. But I think a lot of, especially on the Democratic side, especially to the Black population, we're being sold like really, 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 really hard. And, I don't think we're buying what they're selling anymore. I just think we're more afraid on the Democratic side. We're just more afraid of the Republicans. And so, I mean, you saw it when Hillary said the thing about the hot sauce in her bag on, what was it, Hot 97, whatever station she was on, like they rolled her eyes at her, like while she was there.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So there's a level of like, oh gosh, you know what I'm saying? But then there's but what you gonna do?
Right.
and that's where we are. You know, pandering is okay, y'all got to call me out on this. Before the end of this election season, I want to do a remix of Designer's song, and it's just going to go pander, 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 because that's really all it is. That's really all the Democrats have been doing since day one, and we got to really start calling them out.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree with you there, and I'm glad you brought up it was Hot, whatever it was, Hot 97, Power 102. You know, Sean, I was thinking about this, too, from your perspective, not from your perspective, but if you could speak to the fact, you know, what about hip-hop radio stations and the role that they are playing? I mean, you know, you and I, for instance, we've been involved in a lot of the activist work here in Washington, D.C. We can't get any burn from hip-hop stations, but they'll put the mayor on there to talk about anything. New York, more or less the same thing. You don't see them put the activists on there, but any political figure can show up. I mean, is this sort of another, I don't know if it's like quote-unquote cultural appropriation, but I mean, it almost seems like a counterinsurgency the way they use it.
Well, I would agree with that. And I think more than anything, and I do think it goes beyond mere cultural appropriation. I mean, it's deeper than, say, like, you know, a phenomenon of Macklemore or something, right? I think it actually speaks.
But you know what, though? I feel like people are just too on Macklemore. I mean, I hate to interrupt you, but like, was it cultural? Yes, but he was at the protest in Seattle where they shut down the highway. They maced him in the face. And then you look at these people. What's the dude's name? G-Eazy, the white dude, who is just like all frat rap. I'm drunk, probably date raping people because that's what white frat boys do, I guess. Whoa, slander. But hey, what are you going to do? And it just seems like, to me, he was like the best one. He was owning it more than any other white rapper that like, yes, I am white. Yes, this is a Black art form. And like, I'm going to be out here with y'all in a way that I'd never seen any hip hop artist ever do.
Well, that's fair. Because I mean, if we're talking about white rappers, I mean, you know, I'll take Paul Wall. No, he talks about his diamonds in his mouth and codeine. So, I mean, you may have a point there. But even still, to the issue, I think it speaks more to the sort of hyper commodification of hip hop. Right. to the point where, you know, I think I was David D. based out in L.A. was talking about how he goes into these radio stations and a lot of times they can't even play a record if it's older than a certain amount of years or a certain amount of months. And we all know how it is with like the repetition and stuff like that, to where, you know, you hear a song so many times, you're not sure if you even actually like it or if it's just been kind of drilled into your head. You see what I'm saying? And so on that same sort of corporate model, that same sort of ruling class orientation is why we get some these ruling class analysis, you know, from people that come in, like Hillary Clinton, particularly because I believe that was actually the Breakfast Club she was on. And I think more so than any hip hop show, for whatever reason, that particular show seems to really be the gateway for mainstream forces to try to speak to Black youth culture. And because I know Louis Farrakhan came through there too to pump the Justice or Else thing, right? And so that's really become the nerve center for a lot of that stuff. And it's interesting to your point about, you know, Muriel Bowser, because I know we had we were struggling against her because she was trying to implement this draconian crime bill, essentially trying to flood Southeast D.C. with police, ostensibly to address this uptick in crime, which was based on, you know, statistics that were dubious at best. But this was something that was basically going to criminalize poor and working class Black people in Washington, D.C., and had the audacity to say that she wanted to make Black Lives Matter more than a hashtag, even though she was engaging something that was going to actively have a negative impact on the material conditions of Black folks in the city. So that can get a space. But for us to call out, you know, the negative impact of that, we didn't have that same.
But I would also to push back a little on the radio not being more about this mainstream or corporate structure. Because I actually think, and you all who are more into the music part of the radio can push back on me, but I don't think the radio is as relevant as it used to be, because everyone's now doing podcasts, from Lil Duval to, like, I mean, just everyone's doing podcasting now, particularly about the Breakfast Club. They've, as Sean said, have had everyone from Louis Farrakhan, Bakari Sellers in South Carolina, Michael Blake, who's in the assembly in the state assembly in New York. They had D. Ray McKesson, Dr. Umar Johnson. I mean, it just goes from like extreme to extreme. And of course, inclusive of all of the rappers and Hillary Clinton. So I actually think podcasts are picking up more steam because they can be a little more flexible. So I would push back on that a little bit.
Sean, do you think that they asked Umar Johnson about the conscious stripper controversy on there?
They did.
Or the $250,000 that he stole from people. But I don't want to get on but Monty, go ahead.
So I mean, and I can definitely use like the local radio stations for example. Like, there's nothing about the local radio stations as far as what they air that's decided locally. Their playlist isn't decided locally. You know what I'm saying? DC is forced to carve out a go-go hour because they just wouldn't be able to survive.
But do people listen to them?
So here's the thing. So I agree with you. I think that the podcasts are taking up a space that radio once had. But getting rid of thinking radio is important, which means that you're not going to reach the people who have the lowest common denominator of media access. People who have nothing else, who don't have regular internet access, who don't have podcasts on their cell phone. You know what I'm saying? They just have the radio. They only get the impression that the radio gives them. And the radio doesn't do anything local until they're trying to give something away and it's part of something promotional, or some crime happens that's so heinous that they have to do some kind of town hall about it, quote unquote. But even in that town hall, they will continue to play the destructive, misogynistic, like they literally will go from, man, we got to stop killing each other, to playing the latest Young Thug track. You know what I'm saying? Like,
thank you.
And they don't the radio doesn't understand that. Like, I don't expect commercial radio to be in the forefront of social issues. I expect them to play music. But if they think the world needs to be a better place and their job is to play music, they should play music that makes the world a better place. Like, that's their job. And they don't need to have the conversation, but don't play Young Thug while telling brothers not to kill each other.
No, I hear you. I mean, it's an unbelievable, and it's like a chicken and egg type thing. They say, well, this is what people want to hear. But if I drive from like D.C. to New York, it doesn't really matter if I change the station. It's the same 10 songs, almost in the exact same order, which, if nothing else, shows you that payola, which, for people who don't know, is when record companies pay radio stations to pay your song, is not dead.
I've heard a radio personality around the time when 50 Cent stopped being popular play the latest 50 Cent song, open up the phone lines, and everyone, man for woman for man for woman saying this is a horrible song, and the DJ saying at the end, well, yeah, we're going to keep playing it, though, so you'll get used to it.
Right. So, well, and we are going to take a break, but we will be back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversations about some of the intersections between culture and social movements, and, you know, who knows what else we may get to with this fantastic panel of folks. We are still joined by Bomani Arma, a writer, poet, music producer, MC, and art integration specialist, China Dickerson, executive director of DC Young Democrats, and our very own Sean Blackman, news analyst here at Radio Sputnik. I appreciate you all still being on with us. So, China, I'm going to start with you, with one of our sort of more hot button cultural issues, and that's the situation with Nate Parker, who is the director and I believe the lead actor in Birth of a Nation. Nice sort of interesting use to play on words there. Movie about Nat Turner's rebellion. Obviously, very controversial movie for people who do not know. Nat Turner, widely revered, slave rebellion, 1831, killed some white people as well when they rose up. So he's usually not that celebrated in America amongst non-black people. But either way, long time coming. Here's this movie about Nat Turner. Now Nate Parker is caught up in a controversy in 1992, I believe. He was accused of rape, him and a friend, at Penn State University. He was acquitted. The friend was convicted and then later acquitted. There's a number of things around there. So just setting the tone for those who don't know. So I'll just start with this, China. The big issue that I think a lot of people are saying is it wrong to go see the film when it comes out? Because are you promoting, you know, sexual assault and that type of behavior by allowing him to succeed?
I actually think the opposite. I think you're promoting that we need to learn about our history and that we need to know about Nat Turner, that we need to know about the rebellion. I think we can or should be able to separate individuals from their art. Because if we go down the line of all of the folks who we admire and respect because of the entertainment that they provided us, we would see almost every single person. I venture to say 90% of those people have issues because people are not perfect. And actually, typically the most creative folks are the ones who have been through some craziness. And so they're able to get that out by producing art. I also think that we need to be careful, particularly when we have the dynamics, as in this situation where there's a black man and a white woman who has accused him of rape, that we are not quick to jump to the assumption that he actually did it. Let me say this first. I'm a woman, of course, and I have friends who are women. And I would also venture to say that 90-something% of us have been raped or sexually assaulted. So I do understand that it's a thing and it's a very tragic thing and we need to hold folks accountable. However, not going to see his movie and not putting money in the pockets of all of the actors who are in the movie, the production assistants, the people who prepared the food, all of the people. There's a much longer line of folks who need to be paid and provide for their families than Nate Parker.
Okay, Sean Blackman, what do you think about this question? Should people see it? Should they not see it? Does it matter?
Well, you know, I think particularly since this is a movie about not only about the period of enslavement, but also about a rebellion during that time. And the conversation that we're having about pop culture and politics, it makes me think about other depictions of rebellions and of enslavement that we've seen. I think about, you know, 12 Years a Slave that came out a little while ago that didn't really move me personally. I think about, you know, the Sankofa movie. The movie Columbo, which is even older, and also think about how Danny Glover tried and failed to make another rebellion movie about the Haitian Revolution. And I feel like, honestly, whether folks see Parker's movie or not, I feel like we should all really take this as an opportunity to really, you know, study that history of Nat Turner and of that rebellion and of others that have happened. Now, I know that a movie is a very powerful vehicle. for delivering information. You know what I mean? We can look at, you know, other movies like Spike Lee's Malcolm X and others that really helped restart the conversation around him and the politics that he struggled with, although not to the extent some folks would have liked. But I really don't think there's a substitute for really getting in the weeds and getting in deep about what happened during each of these rebellions, whether we're talking about Nate Turner or Gabriel Prosser or Denmark Veazey, which I know people talked about a lot around the time of the Charleston shooting. But I really don't think there's any substitute for really getting an understanding the fullness of those stories and the context in which they happen.
So I'm torn on the issue as far as how to support the film. I do believe that there should be some weight put in the fact that this is behind him and that he has moved on and that he was acquitted. I also think that we cry all the time that the justice system is rigged. We know the justice system is rigged towards men when it comes in rape cases, but then usually it's not rigged towards black men with white women. So that makes it even more complicated. But then even if you look at the transcript, the third person who would have been involved in this sexual escapade, that the way Nate describes it, said that when he was there, it didn't feel right. It didn't look like she was down, that she was too incapacitated to make a decision. And so I've come to the conclusion personally that he has done something wrong. I haven't decided what level he is wrong, you know what I'm saying? But he did not look out for this woman's best interest. I think that's obvious. The question was, how does me supporting his artwork help other people continue American worldwide rape culture? And I'm not sure what it does. I don't think it makes a difference. But what I do think needs to happen, though, is Nate needs to answer for it every time. Mm-hmm. He needs to answer for it every single time. He cannot avoid the subject. You know what I'm saying? If he's in a press conference, one person asks about him, another person asks about him, don't tell your person moderating to tell them to not ask that question. He needs to have a really good answer mm-hmm. every single time. I do completely think you can separate it. And this is different than like the Bill Cosby situation, because we had already fallen in love with him. You know what I'm saying? And now it's like, I don't boycott Bill Cosby because I still want Theo to get a check. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's still my man.
Theo, who is in suits on USA, so he's getting paid right now.
Right. But I still think that what Bill did artistically and for the black community was great. My sons need to see a different world. You know what I'm saying? My sons probably, when they're old enough, need to see Nat Turner, even though they probably would have read about it before then. But now we're faced with at the beginning of his exploding career, we have an incident. It's also not Bill Cosby in the sense that he is not accused of being a rapist, like a serial, you know what I'm saying, that he did a bad thing when he was 18. I personally would like to find a way for him to more thoroughly apologize and explain for what happened without putting himself in any kind of legal trouble, because I know an apology means he did something, like, but he's got to give us something more than what he said, I believe.
I do think, though, that this is also different than if Nick, because you said, and I'm out of trying to quote you, mm-hmm. but that like Nate Parker's movie, I think this is different because this is about Nat Turner. This is like a pivotal point in history that has been forgotten. I think if Nate Parker produced Finding Nemo, this would be a different conversation.
So the problem is, and this is what someone else pointed out to me, which is a brilliant point. From the beginning of this story, the story has been Nate Parker telling the story of Nat Turner. Mm-hmm. It has been, wow, he raised the money himself. He produced it himself. He took it to the film festivals himself. He signed the contract. And so now that they've completely, and this is something that maybe Fox, when they bought it, should have been like, since you have a shady history, maybe we shouldn't sell this as the Nate Parker telling Nat Turner story.
It is Fox, though. Looking at Roger Ailes, they may not be the most sensitive.
They definitely
aren't. Issues.
They definitely
no,
aren't.
No, I hear
and
you.
So my thing with this, like when it comes with a lot of issues, is like, and this is what the women who are close to me who feel really strong about this say is, when is the incident where we're like, okay, we can no longer, you know what I'm saying? Because I'm always like, yo, how can he redeem himself? Like, I want him to admit that something wrong happened and I want him to feel some kind of pain for it. But also, people who commit these crimes don't disappear.
Right.
They're still
right.
a part of my community.
I know, exactly. I mean, it's a restorative justice piece. And honestly, that's kind of where it turned for me, because this is a story that has been deliberately suppressed, Nat Turner. They wouldn't even give Spike Lee money to make a movie about Frederick Douglass.
Right.
Hollywood does not want movies about black people who are powerful, who are not gangster criminals. They don't want that unless you're like Barack Obama or like Radio and Cuba Gooding Jr. or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, you got to have some something that makes you not relevant. I guess Barack Obama is relevant.
Less threatening.
Yeah, less threatening. Less threatening. And I feel like, although, you know, I don't want to hate on Cuba. He's got some good movies.
So you're thinking I'm going to have a problem with my Denmark Vesey script.
You're going to have a huge problem with that. And so I was like, you know, I'm going to see the movie because at the end of the day, like this story needs to get out there. And it is as unfortunate as it is. But then the way he was talking about it was so ridiculous. Like, I think, I don't even remember if it was Oprah or somebody, and he brings his daughters on the set or his sons, and he's like, "Hey, I live with five women and my mother and my," like, every person who's ever raped somebody has a mother and sister and kid. I mean, whatever. Like, that doesn't mean anything. And so it's just this, like, weird, like, I don't know why they're coming at me. I don't know why everybody's so upset. Look at me surrounded by all these women. I'm great. And I just felt like, wow, like, really? Like, you didn't really seem to take any remorse for it. So I don't know if I'll see it in the theaters. I will bootleg it. But, you know, so I'll see it. But we'll see. Sean.
And that's what really bothered me, because I didn't see that particular interview you're talking about. But I've read a couple of his statements. And what bothered me is how he seemed to sort of, you know, center himself in the whole situation, in the sense of how he's grown and all that kind of stuff since then. And to your point about having however many daughters and whatnot. And it's just like, it doesn't really help your case when in response to an assault, you take the victim out of the equation. You know what I mean? And that's kind of what I read for him. And I mean, you know, it's like when it first came out, when the story first broke, I was like, all right, I might still see it and not pay for it. But then, like, when the whole issue of her suicide comes up, I was like, well, I don't know now. But then again, I struggled with the same issue that China was talking about in terms of, well, you know, that there are other folks with a stake in this that have nothing to do with Park and what he did. So, you know, that's what kind of, again, makes it kind of a conflict for me. So I think at most.
Well,
can I just say one
thing? You most certainly may.
I think this is a bigger conversation about rape culture, but I am actually, so when I've had this conversation with my male friends, it seems like because this is so extreme, like, people think of rape as, so you're unconscious or you explicitly say no, and that's what happened in this case, so he's wrong. But I am telling you, and I'll just speak for myself, I am sexually assaulted every day, every day. And so some of the men who I've been having these conversations with who are like, yeah, he's wrong because he raped her, that word and this sexual assault conversation, we need to have a bigger conversation around, because these same men who are against Nate Parker possibly raping this woman, when I define how I have been sexually assaulted, they say that's not sexual assault.
Right.
So this is just a bigger conversation around why, when Bill Cosby and Nate Parker slipped someone something in their drink, then they're this big rapist. But this actually happens all day, every day,
right,
all the time.
Well, I mean, that's a big part of the street harassment conversation, is how we do it. But let me slightly shift gears to another major cultural event, the Olympics. Now, there's a lot going on with the Olympics. And obviously, you know, this Olympics was like heavily... The thing I couldn't understand, though, is everyone was like, look at how great how it was that black people were featured on the Olympics. I mean, I'm pretty sure, like, the dominant athletes in, like, almost all Olympics on the U.S. team have been black for, like, 30 years. So I don't know how that's even a headline. But that being said, the Gabby Douglas situation, where they got at her for not putting her hand over her heart during the national anthem or whatever after something. And I mean, I just don't even know. I mean, what else can you do? I mean, most people in most sports do not put their hand over their heart. Most people they don't even know the words. Watch any sport, especially the NFL, and there's always like six dudes who they pan to just at the soft lip movement. They don't even know the words. No one knows anything, but this is whatever. It's just a little ceremony. But to get on her in that way, to me, just seemed like, I don't even know what motivated it. It was crazy. I don't know how it struck you, though, China.
I think the comparison you just made is when the Olympics, you're representing the United States of America. So it's not like you're an American team playing against another American team, like in baseball, basketball, like when we have sports within our country, you are representing the United States of America. Now, my parents had always told me, I don't even need to stand up in class, like when they're like, you need to stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance. So I don't think you need to.
I wasn't allowed to stand up. I was in trouble at home if they said the Pledge of Allegiance.
But I do get, if you decide to put on a uniform that says USA and it's red, white, and blue, but then have this attitude of, and I don't know what her attitude was, but then to kind of have this, well, I don't really need to put my hand over my heart, da, da, da. you're not actually then fully being in the uniform, which would be different if you didn't have U.S. That's like me wearing a McDonald's uniform that has McDonald's on it and trashing the fries. Like, so don't work at McDonald's and don't speak, do a public
First of all, mad people who work at McDonald's trash the fries and the food and say, after I worked here for 2 months, I would never work here again.
But there are things that we think are patriotic rules that we don't realize until a black person breaks them, that it's not a patriotic rule. Remember Obama getting in trouble for saluting, for doing a halfway salute of the Marines getting off the airport? Yeah. And then it was like, okay, well, let's research the history of it. And the history is when Reagan started saluting the Marines, at first, the general was like, you're not in the military, dude. Stop saluting people. It's not a requirement. You know, the other girls on the team were not required to put their hand over their heart.
And there's not a wrestler who did the same thing that
it's
had
not
the same
a requirement.
Post.
It's just what you have
norm.
Been. It's
a social
no,
norm.
No, go back to previous Olympics. People are holding their hands behind their back. People holding their hands in front of them.
Baseball, the All-American pastime.
It happens a whole bunch of different ways.
Hold your hands behind your back.
It happens a whole bunch of different ways. And so I think that's part of the thing. The other thing is, I'm a huge social media fan, social media addict, right? Social media people are losers, though, in a lot of sense. You know what I'm saying? Like it wasn't real.
Facts.
It wasn't real people having problems with Gabby. It was people tweeting,
correct,
and then people seeing that people were tweeting, and then they were tweeting that people were tweeting, and then they were tweeting that they were tweeting about them tweeting, and then it became a huge thing.
Right.
And
yeah,
it's like, yeah. And then now, what I was more upset at, they were mad at her attitude. She had the worst Olympics of her career.
Right.
She was mad. Let her be mad. It's fine. You don't have to smile through you not doing exactly what you thought was your best. And so I think we need to give Gabby a break.
Yeah, Sean Blackman, you look like you want to get in there.
Well, no, the only thing that I thought of, I know we're talking about the Olympics, but I also thought of this one cat, and I forget his name because I'm not a big sports fan, but he was in the NBA and he was a Muslim.
Yeah.
Sharif Abdul-Rahim.
Yep.
Right, right.
Very
Sharif.
Important to understand him. Yep.
Right, and he caught a lot of flack, you know, for that as well. So, and we also see that, and I believe, and this is presuming that this isn't one of those photos that were taken out of context, but I believe I also saw a photo of, like, some white athletes who were adults that didn't, you know, put
yes.
their hands over their
yeah.
hearts either, and
yeah.
there was no dust-up over that either. So, I think it's to your point, Bomani, about how, you know, the responses that black folks get and we're not seen fitting into these neat little boxes of patriotism.
Mm-hmm. Michael Phelps' friends did what every Baltimorean does when you hear the national anthem. You scream, oh, I didn't realize that until then, that not everybody does that. He laughed. It wasn't disrespectful because we feel the need to know his backstory and what happened and why it happened. And even if we thought initially it might have been disrespectful, that can't be what he meant because he is a patriot. You can tell by looking at him. But Gabby has to prove over and over again. You can't just look at her until she's a patriot.
Right.
Yes. Well, and the final point of unfortunately, that's going to be the final point of this show. But I just have to say to anyone listening, if you are the person that came up with the moniker for Ryan Lochte, Swim Shady, please contact this show on Facebook. We want to get you out there. Please get out there. But that's going to be it for this edition of By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.